I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Capitalism is the question in an occasional series of shows that we'll keep doing. This one starts with history and a puzzle. How much do good Americans really want to know? Do they need to know about slavery in the foundations of our wealth to this day? In the alliance of Lords of the Lash in the old cotton fields of Mississippi and the Lords of the Loom in the textile mill towns like Lawrence and Lowell, Massachusetts. Beyond that, what part of the privilege and prestige, the very purpose of an Ivy League education at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Brown, traces directly from their founding alliances with slavers and the slave economy? Our guests are point men in a sturdy movement by now among younger American historians to poke through the fog of euphemism, cover-up, denial, to grasp something of how we got here and where we're at, really, in our racial anxieties, our top drawer contradictions, and our split-level underperforming economy. We'll begin with Sven Beckert of Harvard, who has put child laborers, slaves, Bangladeshis in T-shirt factories today into his long biography of this unsinkable empire of cotton. Craig Wilder at MIT came out of graduate school with Sven Beckert. His acclaimed study, Ebony and Ivy, links slavery with elite education from the beginning, not just by the family networks and the money and the proud names that are still on the dormitories at Harvard, for example, but linked by their shared obsessions in the academy and in life with race and race science. His work, too, is about us and now and these institutions today. Sven Beckert, where do you want to take us? And why cotton to begin with? Why is that the only commodity that counts?
Good evening, Chris. It's great to be here. Why cotton? I think cotton is important because looking at the long history of cotton and also looking at cotton in the contemporary world allows me to understand the global history of capitalism. And capitalism in our world today is one of the most important facts. It structures our lives. It structures, obviously, the economy, and it structures the globe as a whole. And as a historian, I wanted to understand how this capitalism developed in the particular ways that it did. And it struck me that in order to do this, you need to take the globe as a whole. You can't understand capitalism by just looking at one particular town or one region or even one country, but you have to look at it from a global perspective. And here, cotton is clearly at the center of the global economy for many, many centuries, and especially during the decisive moment of the Industrial Revolution when Europe and North America became much wealthier than the rest of the world. So looking at cotton allowed me in a way to get at what I think is the very core of the long history of capitalism.
You write in the book that Europe really didn't know cotton to speak of. I mean, it was a wool world. Silk, if you could afford it, or linen. But they didn't really get interested until somewhere in the 18th century, maybe Liverpool, 1780 seems to be a moment. But when they could control the production entirely, they could monopolize it, they could seize it, own it.
Right. So one of my core arguments is that exactly the modern world in which we live today, the modern world of industrial capitalism and constant productivity growth and constant economic growth, is not the world that primarily emerged at the moment when Europeans invented new kinds of machines. But it's a world that emerged much older and emerged out of Europeans' ability to structure global networks and global relations of power. And cotton plays a particularly important role in that story because, as you just mentioned, cotton is a stranger to Europe. It came relatively late to Europe. When it came on boats, cotton cloth being imported from India. And Europeans only began to really manufacture cotton cloth in large quantities in the 18th century. And they were able to do so because at first they were drawing on markets that had already been created by the import of South Asian textiles. into Europe, but also into Africa. They were able to draw on South Asian technologies, and then they were able to draw on the growing of cotton. They were able to draw on the land that they had captured in the Americas and the removal or killing of the native peoples of the Americas. So they came to control a lot of land, and they came to control a lot of labor by the enslaving of Africans and bringing them to the New World. And it was exactly this ability of Europeans to structure global networks that later enabled them to also invest in new machines and then come to dominate the global networks of cotton production, and with it, global capitalism. I mean, this is the moment when global capitalism as we know it emerged.
There's a moment in your book and a moment in history where you write that slavery and the ability to take over the whole Delta in Mississippi brought together all the forces, and it was force of settling the land, owning the labor, and then driving it to plant and harvest, and then eventually, of course, manufacture that cotton. Everything seemed to be connected there in the terms of the expanding global market, but the South, the climate, and most especially the outright bondage.
Right. So when we think about capitalism, I mean, if you ask most people on the street what they think about when they think about capitalism, they will think about free labor, about wage labor. They will think about markets, they think about contracts, and they probably also think about human freedom and perhaps even democratic institutions. But if we actually look at the history of capitalism, we will see that a very important part of its history has nothing to do with free labor, with markets, with contracts, or with freedom, but just with the opposite, with an enormous degree of violence and coercion, with the enslavement of millions of people, with the expropriation of vast amounts of land and, of course, labor, and the very strong presence of imperial states. And so this is as much as part of a history of capitalism as the other history that we much prefer to remember, the history of free labor and contract and freedom and so on.
Well, which leaves a lot out. It moves. It's dynamic. It comes to the United States, not far from where we sit in Lowell. That's the big capital of manufacture. But then eventually it goes south in the 20th century. Then it goes back to Asia. I keep wondering, and I still don't understand, what is it? What's the DNA? What is the driving motive energy inside this incredible machine?
I mean, in the end, I think the driving energy is twofold. There's on the one hand, the people who owned capital or continue to own capital have an interest in investing that capital profitable to increase the amount of capital that they control, and that in itself is an never-ending expansive process, because in the process of accumulation, the amount of capital increases, and of course it seeks out new investment possibilities. And in the 19th century, one of the most profitable investment opportunities that there was to be found anywhere in the world was to invest in the expansion of slave agriculture in the United States. And indeed, many European bankers took great advantage of this fact that the slavery in the United States expands and thrives because the slave owners of the South are able to draw on a vast influx of European capitals, of Dutch and English bankers.
This is still a puzzle to me. It calls upon greed. It harnesses greed and racism and religion and nationalism and all kinds of forces. But what is the it? I'm still puzzling about that philosophically. It is something deep in the human organism to gather and produce and invent and take advantage and then hit the road again.
I mean, I don't know. I'm very suspicious of arguments that find certain characteristics of economic behavior to be natural or within the human DNA. I think this is all particular to particular historical moments. And the history of the world in the centuries before the Industrial Revolution is a history that is of slow economic growth, very little productivity growth. So the dynamics that we see unfolding in the modern era with the transition to capitalism are certainly not the characteristics that we see in human behavior or in the organization of any economy before the modern era. But I think what I argue.
No, granted, but in a way we've seen it ever since. It does mark the marketplace. Yeah. I keep wondering, did it have to work that way? Did it have to be as cruel and as wasteful? Not to mention as destructive of the environment. That's another whole matter. But did it have to work this way?
You know, that's a very difficult question, obviously, to answer. And I think the only thing we know for certain is that it did work in the particular way that it unfolded. And in the way it unfolded, it contained all of these stories of violence and coercion and imperialism and slavery. And obviously, some of these stories in different forms continue to this day.
I keep wondering, is there an antidote for it? Is there a response in human equality or kindness, fraternity, I don't know. Coming up, who knew that the first presidents of Harvard, like the first presidents of this country, owned slaves? And that Harvard houses and dormitories still have the names of big men from the slave economy on them. Craig Wilder makes the college connection with capitalism. But first, here is the voice of Fountain Hughes, one of the last men to work as a slave on American soil. His grandfather was owned by Thomas Jefferson. Here he is telling his own story back in 1949 to the Library of Congress. This is Open Source.
They sell us like you sell horses and cows, and they put you up on the auction bench and bid on you the same as you're bidding on cattle, you know.
Was that in Charlotte that you were a slave, or Charlottesville?
That in Charlottesville. If you were a good person, they wouldn't sell you. But if you were bad, mean, they didn't want to beat you and knock you around, they'd sell you to what they call a nigger trader. Maybe $200, $100, $500. If I thought that I'd ever be a slave again, I'd take a gun and just end it all right away. Because you're nothing but a dog. You're not a thing but a dog.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, finding the roots of American capitalism in slavery with historians Sven Beckert of Harvard and Craig Wilder of MIT. Who knew that the haughtiest names in Puritan Boston had their personal slaves? Who knew that Cotton Mather, the fire and brimstone preacher, gifted his father with his own Negro? Market value, 50 English pounds. His given name was Onesimus. We learn this in our guest Craig Wilder's book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of American Universities. It's about educational power and prestige at the service of a civilization built on bondage. It's an altogether humbling story, Craig Wilder. It's also, as you said to me, frighteningly contemporary. There was war capitalism, then there was industrial capitalism. But back in the old days, we know, for example, John Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony for the famous line that we shall be as a city upon a hill. You have him celebrating the smallpox epidemic that was wiping out those bothersome Indians in the 17th century. You quote him saying, "God hath hereby cleared our title to this place." It's a rapacious history.
Yes.
I wish you'd trace it from the 17th to the 18th into the 21st century as part of our educational landscape, the most prestigious institutions in the world right here.
Sure. You know, when I began the project, one of the things that sort of struck me was when you look at the history of New England and Virginia. Within a decade of their arrival, the British colonists are actually planning colleges. And that seemed quite strange to me. It's fewer than 10 years that it takes them. You know, here in New England, the Puritans arrive in 1630. In 1636, they've got a charter. You know, in Virginia, they're there in 1607. And within a decade, they have a charter for what would have been the first Protestant college in the Americas, the Enrico County College that had been planned. The land, 20,000 acres of land had been given by the Crown and Parliament. 300 people had been sent to work the lands, a rector had been selected, and an Indian war breaks out and destroys that project. So Harvard ends up becoming the first school. But one of the things I took away from that was really I had to think about what was the why that investment in establishing a university, a college, that early in the colonial history, at a time when the Virginians and the New Englanders were actually having trouble with simple realities of colonial life, like the strategic and military defenses of their colonies. And that's when I started thinking, well, the university was actually part of that. The college was a site for actually launching and engaging in cultural warfare against native people. It was part of the colonial project itself. And to remove it from that is actually to, in fact, to do a disservice to history because it distorts that past. And then when you move forward, my lesson from that moment was I really needed to look at each one of these centuries, at each one of these historical periods, and think about what's the thing that the reader really needs to know about the role of colleges in that moment. By the 18th century, certainly, the college is emerging as a central institution in both the defense and the in the defense of the slave trade and slavery. It's becoming a site for actually producing some of the arguments that defend slavery and the slave trade from a rising attack upon both of those institutions in the 18th century world. By the 19th century, it's critical to the Industrial Revolution, and part of its role is actually to defend capital. And it's defending its interest in that way. And I think
there's a scientific bent by then.
Sure. And and by the 20th century and the 21st century, part of the role of the modern university is to reproduce the status quo. And we're actually really quite good at that, especially at elite institutions.
Dare I ask, what's the job in the 21st century of these same institutions that sort of certify what's good, what's rational, what's possible? For the elite?
Oh, I mean, I think one of it is actually really to reproduce the status quo. It's one of the things that has sort of struck me about the behavior of universities, and especially elite universities, in my own lifetime, is our deep sort of the way that we're deeply entangled with many of the greatest social problems, and not always on the right side of them. Mm-hmm. We're very often on the wrong side of them. Yeah.
It's fairly recently, in my experience, that people sort of notice where is the moral, where is the independent, where is the critical thinking voice of the university minds, not their interests, but the brilliant people for whom who justify their existence. Is this new or not?
No, it's not. Yeah, I think one of the things that protects the university from real social critique and historical critique is that universities are the sites for producing their own histories. The university is in the unique position of actually writing the past that it exists in, and that has always served to give it a kind of a elevated spot in the discourse, where we pretend that universities are separate from social reality and historical reality. They simply exist there as kind of, objective observers of what's happening in the past, but they're not really responsible for that past. And part of the central, one of the central arguments in my book is that the university is bound up with that past, and it's messy, it's often ugly, but it's important for us to see.
But let's remember also that, that some people, it's not pure indoctrination, and it doesn't get everybody. In the 19th century, it was critically important. Henry David Thoreau made it through Harvard, class of 1837.
Absolutely.
And the model of civil disobedience and abolitionism and whatnot, and there were surely lots of people less famous and less brilliant, but there. And yet somehow the emotional core of your book, if I may say, is in the story of a guy named Charles Fallon,
yeah.
Beg your pardon, for whom Fallon Street in Cambridge and I think two Fallon Streets in Boston are named. I wish you'd spell that out. He had an unusual and tragic and role.
Let's think about Thoreau and Fallon, because they're all actually contemporaneous. All that's happening at the same time. And in fact, not only on the Harvard campus, but also on campuses in New York, what's now Hamilton University at Amherst and at Williams at Yale, there's in fact a rising anti-slavery movement on all of those campuses. And the Fallon story tells us a lot about what happened to that civil disobedience on campus. Charles Fallon was a German immigrant who had actually escaped from revolutionary Germany, and where he was being sort of persecuted for his own politics. He arrives in Philadelphia. There's a kind of happenstance meeting between him and the Marquis de Lafayette, General Lafayette, who had been invited by Congress back for the 50th anniversary of the American Revolution. Lafayette runs into Fallon in Philadelphia and arranges to send him up to, through his biographer, George Tickner at Harvard, through Lafayette's biographer. They actually arrange for a lectureship at Harvard. He's eventually put in a professorship of the German language. He proves extraordinarily popular with students. And one of the great things about the Fallon story is you can actually follow what he taught in class. And you can see some of his students, their notebooks from that class. So you can also see what they learned.
Their ratings of their professors.
And the very radicalism that had actually, you know, shaped his career in Germany also shapes his career in the United States. He joins the anti-slavery movement. He becomes a key figure in the abolitionist society, and eventually Harvard actually begins to punish him for that. The monies for his professorship are withdrawn. He's actually forced out of Harvard. Mm. He goes to New York, and he sort of trains as a Unitarian minister and from there builds a new church in New England. And then in an irony that connects our two stories, Sven
but
is—
linger on his dismissal from Harvard, and that was a very considered— sort of committee decision, and all the great names, a lot of them tainted by the slave trade, are against him, and they prevail.
Yeah, it's right out of the Board of Trustees minutes. You know, the monies for the professorship had come from some very sensitive sources, including families that were deeply involved in the slave trade right through the early 19th century and whose interests continued to be bound up in both the cotton trades and slavery. And so that withdrawal is actually very political. In fact, actually one of the interesting things that happens right after the meeting where they withdraw his professorship, the very next meeting of the trustees, they announced that George Tickner, the biographer, had actually submitted his resignation. And there's not
good
a lot of
him.
Commentary on that, but Tickner actually makes a few comments about it in personal notes. And so it's quite clear that it's bound up with the Fallon situation.
I keep waiting for outrages like that to be redressed or reconsidered or regretted. Ruth Simmons, as president of Brown University, who, as it happened, was a black woman, chanced to start a major introspection, a sort of examination of conscience at Brown about its own slave roots. Is that possible at Harvard? Brother Fallon ever be vindicated?
Well, you know, think about what happened to Fallon. You know, Fallon goes to New York. He trains as a Unitarian minister. He comes back to New England. He's coming back to actually take the pastorship of a church on a ship crossing Long Island Sound where cotton stored on board, you know, slave-grown cotton steaming toward free New England, is stored too close to a smoke pipe. It catches fire. The ship catches fire. And Fallon dies on that ship. In the aftermath of that tragic death, there are some attempts to sort of clean up the relationship between Harvard and Fallon. And there's some sense that, you know, of paying a kind of debt to Fallon's memory. There's some statements of regret that come from a few administrators. It certainly does also give some new energy to the abolitionist. But the real challenge of the Ruth Simmons moment is not only that she had the courage to really look at Brown's relationship to slavery and the slave trade, but one of the things that was telling to me is that in the aftermath of Brown's report in 2006, none of Brown's peer institutions took the same step. You know, and in fact, actually, if you look at the campuses, what really happened on those campuses were grassroots movements of faculty, graduate students, undergraduates doing their senior theses, librarians and archivists who began to explore the relationship between these individual universities and slavery. Sven Beckert's course on Harvard and slavery, for instance, kept this story going for the next few years. And it took a long time for the administrations to catch up.
But let me ask you, I mean, is Drew Faust, the president of Harvard, Civil War historian, is she ready to look further? Is she under pressure not to?
You know, I think it's difficult. When you think about all of the presidents, I won't even individualize it. I think when you think about all of the university presidents today of the elite universities in the United States, one of the major pressures on them is fundraising, development. And in that world, it's very difficult to take up things that are difficult social questions and potentially controversial. And so it's much easier to delegate that responsibility to faculty, independent scholars, and to the scholarly world, and to say that you're doing your job because you've created open access to the sources. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's the moral responsibility of institutions to examine their own history, especially when they claim that they exist for the pursuit of truth and to deliver, in fact, real social benefits to the greater public.
Sven Beckert, I wonder— I mean, the Fallon story, and it's a heartbreaker, is still sort of university politics. Does it fit in your framework, though, of the way capitalism works?
No, I think it does fit in a couple of ways. I mean, for one, I think it speaks to the fact that New England, even though by the 1840s and 1850s, New England did not have slavery anymore in its own land, but it was still tightly linked to the slave economy of the American South and the Caribbean, and therefore slavery remained a very touchy issue to the elites of New England, including the elites who came to run Harvard University, and indeed many of them were directly implicated in the trade of agricultural commodities grown by slaves, also in the slave trade, and then especially in the investment in cotton manufacturing enterprises that drew on the slave-grown cotton from the American South. But I think what's also really striking about this story about how American elite universities have dealt with the history of slavery is that in a way you could think, okay, this is, you know, slavery was abolished in the United States in 1865. That's now approximately 150 years ago. That's a long time. Nobody who is alive today is directly personally responsible for the history of slavery. But still, somehow slavery is still so close to us that we can't actually face its history, which I find it testifies to the continued importance of slavery, but I think makes it, as Craig says, it makes it the moral responsibility of our time as well to face that history, and universities should be the first institutions who are embracing that confrontation with their own past. But as Craig just mentioned, obviously it is very difficult for them to do so.
Go back one step. Could we have had the marvels of cotton in all its inexpensive T-shirt, elegant, colorful varieties, could we have had that miracle of that commodity without slavery?
You know, again, that's a difficult question to answer because the way how that the history unfolded was obviously with slavery at its very core. But I think the problem of the late 18th century European cotton industry was to secure huge quantities of inexpensive cotton for these suddenly much more productive machines and for these vast markets that they had captured in Africa, Asia, Europe, and elsewhere. And at this point, it was very difficult for European governments or for European merchants to transform peasant agriculture in places such as India, West Africa, or the Ottoman Empire. And so they turned to the Americas and they turned to slavery because this was the one way how they were able to secure the land and the labor to grow ever more cotton at ever cheaper prices. The price of cotton in the 19th century falls quite significantly. That allows these manufacturers to be ever more competitive on world markets. That allows them to destroy the home spinning and handloom weaving in places such as South Asia and West Africa and elsewhere.
Different subject. You men are both sort of stars in this expanding field of capitalist history, the history of this beast. And not to put it down either, but make the case, if you will, for history as a way of getting to know something, as opposed to all the other ways we hear about our economy in the day-to-day statistics, the stock market or the unemployment rate or whatnot. It's a revelation, and it's exciting to see these long-term narratives. But tell us what you're doing, and is this an opportunity? I mean, first of all, Thomas Piketty has said he thought of his book on capital as much history as economics, and he says it's a disgrace. He didn't say disgrace. It's an embarrassment that economists have spent so much time in their arcane mathematics so far from the human story or the whole picture. Make a case for what you guys are trying to do.
You know, I think historians become historians for different reasons, but Sven and I both actually spent more than a decade on these books and then, in fact, actually joked with and competed with each other for how long it would take us to finish these projects. And one of the reasons why you make that investment is I think that history actually has answers to social questions and pressing social crises that we need to address. As Sven said, you know, at some point in time, you have to turn and face that past. And there is, in fact, I think, a kind of emotional and guttural reaction to the history of slavery 150 years after its demise that continues to haunt Americans. And I would argue that part of that is actually that the story of slavery disturbs a central narrative that we've all come to sort of embrace in some way, shape, or form. It places, for instance, Native Americans and African Americans as central to the story of the rising American empire. And that's difficult to actually, you know, put in harmony with the other things that we choose to believe about ourselves. But in fact, that's where the answers to our real social questions are.
But there's another angle here, and I think it's part of your opportunity. After the 07-08 meltdown, whatever we call it, people are scratching their heads and saying, wait a second, remind me, what's so perfect, what's so eternal, what's so God-given, you know, from Sinai about this system, and can't we tweak it without being called commies or socialists even? Can't we complain and know more?
Right. I mean, look, I think first to answer your previous question, I think I think historians have a great responsibility and also the opportunity to speak to the question of the long history of economic change in ways that is quite different from how economists speak to them. I mean, as you mentioned, economists often, not always, but often try to find kind of general laws that explain how particular people relate in market economies. And they also try to use mathematical tools to answer these questions. And I think historians have a historical view of capitalism. They actually look at capitalism in action, how capitalism actually unfolded. Mm-hmm. And that tells a story about capitalism that is quite different than the one that we learn from the business pages of some newspapers.
We're talking about the braided history of cotton, capitalism, slavery, and also educational privilege. Coming up, what could it mean for an Ivy Leaguer putting on a new Uniqlo t-shirt or looking at the bargain clothes at H&M or Forever 21? I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Here was President Obama 2 years ago on the slavery that abides.
But around the world, there's no denying the awful reality. When a man desperate for work finds himself in a factory or on a fishing boat or in a field, working, toiling for little or no pay and beaten if he tries to escape, that is slavery. When a woman is locked in a sweatshop or trapped in a home as a domestic servant, alone and abused, and incapable of leaving, that's slavery.
Craig Wilder of MIT, author of Ebony and Ivy. Sven Beckert of Harvard, author of Empire of Cotton. Can we take that straight about slavery in the modern world today?
Sure. I think one of the things that actually reminds me of is actually what Sven said earlier, you know, that the history of brutal economic relationships, free economic relationships, has always been, in fact, wrapped up with the history of capitalism. From its very origins, and it continues today.
Sven?
Right. I very much agree with that. Violence and coercion certainly persist very much in the contemporary economy. And in some ways, I think that also relates to the issue that we discussed earlier about the university and its unwillingness to face its own past. I think because our vision is limited, we look around the world in which we live and we see certain things, but there are many things happening in the world that we cannot see with our own eyes. And I think there is a lot of brutality in labor relations, for example, in much of the world that we, you know, only see at moments when there are great catastrophes. But I still think that plantation slavery as it unfolded in the Americas in the 19th century or in the 18th century is something that is quite different from, you know, let's say women workers in Bangladesh locked into a factory. I mean, I don't want to diminish the terrible nature of their work experiences, but I think there is something really fundamentally different between that and enslaving an entire people for centuries.
Yes, but as you wrote, Sven Beckert, cotton production itself is still, you said, an often brutal ordeal, and it drives farmers in the hundreds, maybe thousands, into debt and despair, to suicide. At the end of your book, you write, the empire of cotton has continued, and this is just cotton, continued to facilitate a giant race to the bottom, limited only by the spatial constraints of the planet. If we could find other planets, we'd take it there. But I want to use both of your books as a kind of consciousness-raising exercise. What is it that we are euphemizing in this world today? What are the other commodities and the other kinds of suffering comparable to the centrality of cotton in that you wrote about? Surely the central commodity today is oil. But you could also say, let's talk about drugs. Let's talk about corn or human trafficking. Maybe bananas. That's never been easy to produce. Or maybe it's, you know, the phone-making capital of the world, Foxconn, in China. I want you to raise our consciousness about what we should be paying attention to today.
Let me also, I want to affirm Sven's point. I actually think that it's historians are always going to argue for historical specificity. And you know, if everything is slavery, nothing's slavery. And so we always want to be careful about that. But one of the things, to answer your question directly, that I think this history tells us and actually begins to reveal to us is that the history of the marketplace, markets also hide us, shield us from the moral consequences of much of our economic behavior. That's true in the 17th and 18th century, and it's true in the 21st century. We walk into stores, and we're actually shielded from the social realities of production.
Yeah.
That's also true in the 18th century world. You know, one of the realities for one of the reasons why the arguments against slavery and the arguments against the slave trade took the form that they did, often, in fact, for instance, introducing evidence of the inhumanity and the brutality of these trades, wasn't that the world didn't know, the Western world didn't know that those trades were inhumane. It was actually that the market tended to shield us from any direct contact with that reality. We could hide from it and pretend it wasn't there.
The market shields us. We shield it ourselves. I'm thinking...
Oh, yeah. No, we're complicit in it. We're absolutely complicit in it.
Let me speak for myself. I see those Uniqlo T-shirts. The colors are fantastic. The V-neck thing is just right. The price is incredibly low. And I buy it. And then I don't think, as obviously I should. Wait a sec. Who's paying for this? And who's suffering for my whim?
So your T-shirt, for example, the cotton that went into that T-shirt might have been harvested by children in Uzbekistan who were forced to do so. It might have been worked up into thread and spun into fabric by very poorly paid workers in China, and then stitched together into clothing by workers in Bangladesh who work under really impossible conditions at a great risk to their own health. And that explains why the T-shirt that you're going to buy at some stores is going to cost you just $4 or $5.
What about the people who make phones? You know, for that absolutely marvelous design that Steve Jobs has left us.
I mean, I don't know exactly what the work conditions are in Chinese factories producing iPhones, but I can't.
You
the,
can.
Yeah, the reports have been horrific, but yeah, it's not what I study directly, but yeah.
You can. Any of us can go to YouTube and put in Bangladesh textiles, and you can see inside these mills. They're humming at an incredible rate. They're dark. It's hard to measure the danger, but we can know if we want to know.
Right. But I think we should also see that so I don't think all of it is, I don't think we should draw a picture of the world that is all but hopeless, because I think there are moments when people have actually been able to improve their conditions. They have mobilized collectively. They have formed trade unions. They have formed political parties to advocate for their interests. And they sometimes were able to persuade states to create welfare systems that improved their situations. There is great misery in the world, but there's certainly also people who are with very little social power actually have managed to generate very significant transformations. And I think in a way the best example for that is the struggle during the American Civil War itself, when many enslaved Americans managed to make this war a war of their liberation.
The heroes in your book, if I may say, are the people who from time to time all over the place come forward with outrage. There's a girl, I think her name is Ellen Hooten, in Manchester maybe, 8 or 10 years old. Tell that story and how somebody made an issue of what was being done to this child.
Yes, so Ellen Hooten was a girl who came from very, very poor parents. And when she turned 8, she was, like many other children at this time, was sent by her mother to work in a cotton textile factory. And she somehow did not perform the task satisfactorily. And her overseer penalized her by putting a piece of heavy iron around her neck. So this was a form of torture, and she ran away. And eventually, a group of middle class citizens from Manchester investigated this case because they thought it constituted a form of child slavery.
You told the Fallon story, Craig. I mean, who are the other voices that you just want to clone? You want to learn about and be led by?
You know, there are a lot of them. I think, you know, he doesn't show up much in my book, but John Wesley, you know, the founder of Methodism, has a fascinating moment with the history of slavery in 1774 when he writes his Thoughts Upon Slavery. And one of the things that he argues in that short pamphlet is that England's investment in slavery and the slave trade had brought about the moral ruin of the nation. And he actually writes something along the lines of, it would be better that all of England's possessions in the Americas sink into the sea than that they be cultivated at so high a cost to human dignity and moral justice. You know, that through one of the things that I really wrestled with in the book and I wanted readers to see was that there was, in fact, always a critique of slavery and the slave trade.
Yes.
And one of the things that happened on campus, you know, when you're talking about Charles Fallon, the real lesson for me of what happened to Fallon at Harvard was that it was precisely the entanglement of the university with slavery that led university administrations and trustees to act aggressively against students and faculty who dared to question the institution. And it happens over and over again on campuses in the 1830s.
There's a kind of, should we say, focused moral energy in both of these books. I mean, it's real history, but it's asking us to do something. And I wonder just what, other than wake up, don't buy the hype. Don't buy the Uniqlo ads necessarily, but then what? In the way of politics, in the way of reform, in the way of repentance, what do you want your readers to be doing, Sven?
That's an excellent question that is unfortunately very difficult to answer. But I think the first thing I would like my readers to do is to come to an understanding of how the world emerged in which we live today, and to face the consequences of this long history. And I think it does give perhaps readers a sense that there are possibilities, as I mentioned earlier, there are possibilities for change to take place. And often that calls upon very courageous individuals like the ones we just heard in Craig's story. And sometimes it means that people need to organize collectively in trade unions and other such institutions to improve their situation. So you know, unfortunately, there is not an easy story, and in some ways, the history that I tell is a dark one. It's one that not easily lends itself to hope. And if you look at the world today, as you mentioned, you know, if you look at the distant parts of the world, things are sometimes difficult. But if you look at, you know, if you look here, right, at the United States, you see rising inequality, you see the mass imprisonment of poor people, you see homelessness. I mean, there are, you know, things right in front of our doorsteps, so to speak, and we are not doing a particularly good job handling those problems.
Craig Weller, what do you want your readers to do?
You know, I think for me, there's a truer, there's a more painful, complicated, and difficult but honest view of the past that's the real foundation for political and social discussions today. And until we actually wrestle with that past, we can't wrestle with contemporary problems
very
honestly or efficiently. Well, I think, you know, a lot of things that we've been talking about, you know, economic inequality, questions of social injustice, the criminalization of the poor are current phenomena that are actually rooted in our history. And until we actually address that reality, what we end up doing is actually having a conversation about nothing rather than a conversation about reality.
I was going to say, having worked in journalism all my life, I keep wondering, why is the public discussion, including the political discussion, so sort of benighted? Think of all the chin-wagging wasted around that silly instance of, I made this, you know, in the presidential campaign. Did I make this company or did I not? I mean, why don't we have, in every public conversation, a more, you know, real understanding of a big universe of education and training and technology and investment that nobody makes anything in that sort of individual way. And we're not even beginning to approach what has to be done to make it fairer, to make it more representative, closer to what we insist on.
I think scholars can often make the mistake of imagining that we're more important than we are to social realities. In fact, that's somewhat seductive in academia. But one of the things that I think is true is that, you know, for Sven's book, for my book, for a lot of the recent work on slavery, on the history of capitalism and the early history of the United States, there's a growing audience for a different kind of conversation that has made our projects possible. And I think part of
where
that is...
Where do you find it?
I think both in the, you know, the willingness of publishers to take up very different kinds of projects, to actually sustain them over long periods of time. These are long research projects. They're in-depth research projects. You know, his is a very serious study of Cotton. There's no playing around there. And I think that there's a different public appetite for some of these conversations. And so when I'm actually thinking about what's hopeful in these discussions, you know, my book isn't a book that actually leaves you feeling great about the world either at the end of it. But what I am hopeful about is that actually looking over the past decade in Europe and in the United States, there's been, in fact, an increasing audience for a more complicated, honest, and difficult discussion of the past than has been there before. I don't think that we're, you know, I don't think we're a nation that is anti-intellectual. I think we're a nation that has a convenient habit of blinding ourselves at long moments, when in fact that's consistent with our material interest. I think those interests have started to change. You know, I think 40 years of income inequality and growing disparities, a shrinking middle class and an increasingly desperate working class have simply changed the public appetite for what kinds of intellectual conversations we need and we want.
Right, and I think then the history of that we are trying to write here is of great political relevance, because it does try to at least to explain how we got into the dilemmas in which we find ourselves today, and perhaps that in itself can be an empowering thing to do. And after all, this is what we do best. You know, we are historians, and so we write history, and we hope that people are going to read these books and that they're going to draw their consequences from what they have learned. But I think one, you know, in a way, our contemporary political conversation is so much dominated by a view that tries to naturalize the world in which we live right now, to take that as the world as it should be. And I think what historians can do is to explain that this is just one of many possible worlds.
Well, the economists, I mean, as a trade group, one of the most powerful factions in this country, with all their arcane, dismal science, will they let you in on this conversation? Or I mean, one senses in the general public discussion, we're all supposed to believe that we're somehow recovering slowly from that unfortunate coincidence of, you know, bad events in 07 and 08, but we're doing fine, and there's nothing fundamental to be discussed here.
You know, first, I don't think the conversation is owned by the economist. I think it's a public conversation. And my other sense is that, you know, the public can't wait for the academics to save them. You know, we do projects that we think are socially relevant and that we hope will actually help push forward the public discourse. But ultimately, the project of actually improving people's lives is a public project. And that's where we're simply citizens who want to see a better nation and a better world.
Last word, Sven Beckert.
Right. I agree.
Good. Thank you both. Thank you for your work. We've all been reading these books with a kind of exhilaration, I must say. It sounds so real. And thank you for all of it.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Sven Beckert's book is The Empire of Cotton. I think just Empire of Cotton. Craig Wilder's is Ebony and Ivy. You can find a lot more on our website, radioopensource.org. About the hidden story of slavery at Harvard, with pages straight from the 18th century archives, and more of the voices of freed slaves from the Library of Congress. We're going out on Hans Zimmer's soundtrack from the movie 12 Years a Slave. Our show was produced this week by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, with help from Rebecca Panovka and Maria Jose Fabre. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our benign overlord. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.